Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post, who is now the letters editor at The Washington Post. Very exciting news there. And Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine, just boring old Peter, same as usual. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm very excited. And since Sonny has mentioned this new job, I want to assure listeners I am not going anywhere. You will pry my Yeti mic out of my cold dead hands across the movie aisle forever.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends who are not leaving the podcast.
All right. Before we get started on this week's episode, I just wanted to give everyone a heads up that we are doing another Across the Movie Aisle live show. It's going to be next month, Tuesday, April 9th, 7 p.m. at the Bryant Street, D.C. location of the Alamo Drafthouse. We're going to be showing Denis Villeneuve's Arrival, much beloved by all three of us. So that's going to be a fun one to talk about. For all the love his Dune movies have gotten, I still think that this, alongside Sicario, to be fair, is his masterpiece. It's an amazing bit of filmmaking. I have lots of thoughts about this movie compared to some other movies that involve time travel-y stuff, but we'll talk about that. I just think it's really well done, the whole thing, and I am looking forward to discussing it with Peter and Alyssa. And guys, that is your home theater, right? Are you excited to have bring folks into your house and make them comfortable, show them around?
Yeah, and we're doing this on the big show at Bryant Street, which is, I think, the largest screen in the district proper. It is my favorite place.
That is not an IMAX
movie. That is not an IMAX. Yes.
It is my absolute favorite screen to watch a movie on, and it's going to be a thrill to see this because we weren't able to see this at an Alamo Drafthouse when the movie came out, and so the Bwoms will be tuned even better.
Yes. I actually just found The Notebook when I saw Arrival for the first time when it came out, so I'm really excited to look back at my notes and see, you know, how, as like a childless 30-something, I responded to a movie that now, like, I will probably cry loud enough in this screening that you can hear me, and then you can all make fun of me afterwards, and we can go to the bar.
You're not going to be able to hear Alyssa over the sound system at the big show.
I've never been to an Alamo Drafthouse big show screen before. We don't have one in my local drafthouse, so I'm excited to see what the fuss is. See if it's so much better than every other screen. So I'm looking forward to that. Again, it's Tuesday, April 9th, 7 p.m., Bryant Street, D.C., seeing Arrival. There will be a link to it in the email. So, you know, make sure you act quick because those tickets are going to go fast. All right. First up in controversies and non-troversies, let's get to the show. It looked like we were going to get through Oscars night without much in the way of political controversy, you know, some speeches from the winners of the Zone of Interest, you know, there's some controversy there. But, you know, just in terms of partisan politics, we were going to get out of it without getting a lot of partisan politics. Don't want that partisan politics. And then right before the last couple of awards, you know, Jimmy Kimmel comes out on the stage and he started reading a review of his performance. Has there ever been a worse host than Jimmy Kimmel at the Oscars? This reviewer asked. His opening was that of a less than average person trying too hard to be something which is not and never can be. Get rid of Kimmel and perhaps replace him with another washed up but cheap ABC talent, George Sloppenopoulos. It's clever that. And then Kimmel teased, you know, guess which politician ended this review with a shout of Make America Great Again. That's right. Managed to go almost the whole show without a real mention of Donald Trump, which is, of course, the thing Donald Trump wants most in the world, is to be acknowledged and, be the center of attention until right at the end. And Kimmel couldn't help but crack, isn't it past your jail time, in response to the jibes from the former president? Now, look, I'm of two minds on this. Okay. All right. On the one hand, obviously, going after Trump, fair game. Not just because he took a shot at Kimmel, but also because he's a ridiculous and horrible human being. And it's perfectly fine to make fun of him for being indicted a billion times for 7 billion different crimes. And we should all be willing to make fun of his ongoing effort to undermine American democracy by refusing to concede that he lost the election in 2020. Screw Trump. I don't care. On the other hand, though, this is it's the sort of thing that gives him precisely what he wants. It allows him to throw down the grievance card that he loves, that his base loves, these gibbering idiots that he can say to them and say, look how much Hollywood hates me and therefore hates you. We are oppressed by the muckety mucks in Hollywood who are too woke to create anything you might enjoy seeing. Can you believe this disrespect? This disrespect that they're showing, they would turn Oscar night of all the most sacred of nights into a partisan affair. Can you believe it? You should stick it to them by voting for me. Because you know that's what they're all thinking right now. Going after Trump in this setting is the equivalent to an in-kind contribution for his campaign. From Kimmel's tone to the dutiful clapping and laughing of all the stars in the room, the thing becomes an instant fundraiser for the Trump apparatus and yet another lever of resentment for him to pull. Peter, I gotta ask, I mean, should the former host of The Man Show have just let this slap by the co-star of Home Alone 2 Lost in New York go? Shouldn't he have just let it go?
Well, you know what? I think the lesson here is one. The way to think about this is the lesson that we have all had to learn over the last decade or so on social media. And that lesson is don't feed the trolls. No, really, really don't feed the trolls. Just don't do it. And a big part of Trump's political and cultural persona, especially these days and especially on social media, is that he is a troll. And if you respond to the trolls, you empower them. If you respond to the trolls with a great witty comeback and really, you know, just clap back and it's so brilliant, you still empower them. If you respond to the trolls kindly and patiently and with wisdom, it's still empowering them. If you respond to the trolls with great clear evidence and all sorts of citations and power, and like, it still empowers them every single time, no matter what you do. The only way to win this game is not to play. It's just like that movie that we hosted at the Alamo last year, right? Like, this is the thing, and right? And I don't think it's that big a deal. I don't think, I think you are right to mock the idea that there's sort of, that there's like a MAGA-loving Trump base that is also deeply invested in the Oscars and in particular in the Jimmy Kimmel parts of the Oscars. To some extent, it's like, fine, this is just how it goes. But I don't think that it made sense in this circumstance, especially coming off of a couple of rough years for Hollywood, where they have, in fact, had trouble reaching audiences. I think there is now a clearer than ever business case that Hollywood has moved at least a little, maybe not wildly, and maybe you can overstate this point, but at least a little, at least in some cases, sort of to the progressive identitarian, whatever, or just partisan left in ways that have been counterproductive to the business part of Hollywood, and also to the sort of the social value part of Hollywood, which is that they entertain us and they bring people together to enjoy things. And what Kimmel did was, I think, not in that spirit. I don't care that much. I don't think it's that big a deal. I don't think it is something that is like, oh man, he just ruined an otherwise great Oscars. This is what you get with Jimmy Kimmel. But don't feed the trolls. It's never been a good idea.
You know, Alyssa, one thing I want to make a distinction here with, because there are folks who argue that nobody should ever mention Trump. Trump should not be mentioned. You shouldn't show his campaign rallies. You shouldn't show his speeches. That it gives too much attention to him. It makes him the center of attention. It deprives oxygen from everybody else in the room. This is one of the arguments about the 2016 election. One of the big knocks on the media was, oh, he got, you know, $6 billion in free advertising or whatever the number was because he was on the TV so much. And I think that's wrong. I actually think that's wrong. I think you have to, if you are covering Trump, if you are covering politics, you cannot cover politics without covering Trump, because he is the GOP candidate. He's been the GOP frontrunner this whole time. There was never a period of time where he was not the head of the party. And you abdicate your responsibility by not covering him. This is not that, though. There was no need for this, except for frankly, Kimmel knew he was going to get a good, cheap bit of clapter by doing this, right? I mean, that's kind of what it comes down to. Just for the entertainment value of it was lacking.
Yeah, no, if I were going to do this joke, the way I would have done it is to round up like a bunch of ridiculous tweets from complete randos and like read them off and like dropped a little bit of something from Trump on Truth Social and like as part of sort of a montage, because then the joke becomes like you put it in with like a bunch of ridiculous complaints about the show and then you make him like small, right? You don't give him the sort of sole attention. You make him just like another crazy old man yelling at the cloud. I still don't think that would have been a very good joke, but it would have been a little less like, oh, I'm gonna, you know, go rope-a-dope with Donald Trump. Like, who cares, right? And I think the other thing that Peter didn't mention, because, you know, Trump is a troll, but Trump is also like a grown-ass man who basically behaves like a toddler all the time. And as someone who's currently raising a toddler, you don't react to their craziest behavior in sort of an extreme way, because a reaction is a reaction and it feeds them. But you also don't do it because it makes you feel bad and futile and ridiculous, ultimately. And so there is this parenting tactic that suggests that when your kids are being deranged, you speak to them more and more quietly, because then they have to quiet down to hear you. Like, they fundamentally want to hear you, but you're quiet and controlled. They quiet down to hear you. And then you also don't feel like you've lost your mind. And I think that, you know, sort of dashing oneself against the rocks of Donald Trump over and over again, like, you know, it's, you're going to end up all cut and bruised and the rock is still going to be there, right? And so it was sort of a bummer. And what I actually thought was a pretty good Oscar ceremony and a pretty good set of results to kind of have this thing just intrude on the proceedings, like, even if you get the clapter, it doesn't really make you feel that good and it doesn't accomplish anything. And why not just go on and like live your life as you want to live it and have that be the example?
I would also make a distinction here just between Kimmel and, say, a winner of an award making an anti-Trump statement or a statement about partisan politics. It's not that I would necessarily come on this show and the next day and be like, you know what? It was really great to hear how Emma Stone felt about the California Senate race or whatever. Right. That's not exactly what I'm looking for. But it's different when you get 30 seconds or 60 seconds a year, maybe not really even a year, one time or a few times over the course of your career to address the Oscars audience. Jimmy Kimmel has not just done the Oscars for however many years. He also has it's every night, right? A late night talk show where he can beef with Trump all he wants and tell all the dumb, snarky, like, I'm going to make fun of Trump and MAGA jokes that he wants. And there's clearly an audience for that on his show, because as I understand it, that is a big part of his show. To bring that to the Oscars, I think, suggests a mistaken conceptualization about what the appeal and purpose of the Oscars and the Academy Awards ceremony is.
Yeah. And again, I don't think anybody is sitting here saying, oh, well, there should be no politics. And, you know, everyone should just thank their publicists and be done with it.
I do think some people think that, but that's not.
Well, that's not what we're saying. Yeah. That's not what we're saying. And I look, again, my issue is just tactically.
Yeah.
Tactically, it's unsound. It is unsound because it just provides fodder for him in terms of fundraising, in terms of attention, in terms of cementing, not that he really needs any help cementing his grip on the base of the Republican Party, as we've seen over these last few months. But it just is like, don't do this. Just don't do it. Find a better way. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Trump finally got his mention, got his time in the spotlight at the last minute during last night's Oscars? Peter?
It's maybe a minor controversy, but it's not that big a one. Like I said, I don't think this is all that big a deal.
Alyssa?
Dumb, but not a controversy.
I think it's a controversy. I think we all need to get to a place where we're having a little more self-restraint when it comes to this dingus.
Self-restraint. But, you know.
Self-restraint in the face of dingusism is my new model. All right, make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode on Robert Downey Jr., whose win for Best Supporting Actor at the Oscars on Sunday felt like a lifetime achievement award of sorts. He was so happy. Everyone was so happy for him. Good for him. Good for RDJ. Speaking of the Oscars, on to the main event. The Oscars were this Sunday, and guys, I gotta be honest, this was the best ceremony I've ever seen in my entire life. It will never get any better than this. This was it. I'm just gonna stop watching the show from now on. It wasn't just that all the correct movies and nominations won, though I think the winners were pretty spot on. And it wasn't that the whole thing zipped along, though it helped that the ceremony started an hour earlier than usual, meaning that, you know, a 3.5-hour show ends at 10:30 Eastern instead of 11:30 Eastern. I was done with the show by like 9:30 or so, my time, in the Central Time Zone. It was great. It's a real boon for folks who have to, you know, go to work and deal with kids and stuff on Monday morning. So let's tackle this in two parts. Part the first, there's the ceremony itself. And I'll be honest, I was a little worried as things kicked off. You know, Kimmel's monologue was fine. He's fine. It's not inspired, right? I wasn't rolling on the couch or anything, but it was serviceable. I chuckled a couple times. And then there was the first award for supporting actress. And then they had recycled the bit from years past where previous winners come onto the stage and introduce the nominees. And I got to be honest, guys, again, I was worried. I was a little worried here. It took forever. It was kind of blah. It wasn't really that good. But then things picked up speed, and the ceremony itself was fun, and it was funny. Stand-up comedian John Mulaney did this great bit where he basically made the case for him to be the host of next year's show with a whole thing about Field of Dreams. It was wonderful. It was both rambling and tight somehow, which is like the John Mulaney experience in a nutshell. He's the most innately funny person I think I've ever seen take a stage. He's wonderful. I just love watching him. John Cena did this very funny bit where he came on stage naked to present Best Costume, which gave him another chance to show off his comedic chops. Nicolas Cage reminded everyone in the audience that he's down for whatever with his having actors introduce other actors thing was very hit or miss all night. But Nicolas Cage and Sam Rockwell did wonderful jobs with their duties there. And then Al Pacino showed up hammered. He was lit. Just absolutely lit. And he looks at the envelope and he's like, what do I see? Oh, Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer's best picture, sure. Fun times. It was great. Enjoyed it. But the best moment from the ceremony portion of things, again, just the actual ceremony, was Ryan Gosling's star-studded performance of I'm Just Ken, where he not only sang the song, but danced in front of dozens of backup singers, while Slash from Guns N' Roses and Wolfgang Van Halen took the stage, and everybody was just hooting and hollering in the crowd. I have repeatedly argued on this show and elsewhere that Ken is the best part of the Barbie movie, and I want to personally thank Ryan Gosling for proving my point at the ceremony on Sunday. And I know there are some quibbles about the ceremony. The in memoriam segment, you know, it was too focused on the dancing and the singing, whatever. There are always quibbles about the in memoriam segment in terms of who should have gotten more attention, who should have gotten a bigger applause, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I wish there had been a little recognition for Martin Amis, whose book The Zone of Interest is at least nominally responsible for two awards at this year's show. Cormac McCarthy could have gotten a little more love. He got like a little, his name was on the wall behind the screen while everybody was singing and dancing. But, you know, whatever. Like I said, every year somebody complains about this. It's fine. That's just how it goes. The awards are why we're here. And I have to say that every winner felt just about right. My only real complaint in terms of the winners was American Fiction taking Best Adapted Screenplay, as Cord Jefferson's screenplay was the only adaptation in that group that took something interesting and made it much worse. The only real race of the night in the major categories was between Emma Stone and Lily Gladstone. And while I was surprised, I was honestly surprised, I was kind of shocked that Emma Stone beat out Lily Gladstone. I did not think there was any chance they were going to give Emma Stone her second Oscar and not give Lily Gladstone the statue as the first Indigenous woman nominated for Best Actress. I was shocked, but it's not a horrible pick. She's really good in Poor Things. I didn't love that movie. I didn't think it entirely works, but the reason it does work is because she's so crazily committed to it. So I don't know. That worked out fine. Poor Things wound up taking most of the awards people thought Barbie might. And I'm honestly fine with that because Barbie's not that good. But Poor Things did a really wonderful job of set design and costuming. It deserved what it won. And I appreciated the win for 20 Days in Mariupol and the speech that the director gave that was a blunt and forthright statement of right and wrong in the face of horrifying evil. It was nice to see a director for one of these films hop up on stage and take the right side of a hot button issue without equivocating or making apologies for terrorists and their supporters. That was nice to see. The big winner of the night, of course, was Oppenheimer and Christopher Nolan. Nolan has had a long and, shall we say, complicated relationship with the Oscars. It was the snub of The Dark Knight for Best Picture in 2009 that led to the expansion of the Best Picture slot from 5 to 10 movies. But the Oscars got it mostly right when it came to Oppenheimer, taking home statues for Best Cinematography, Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor, Best Editing, Best Score, Best Director, and Best Picture. The only other award I think it deserved was, as I said, Best Adapted Screenplay. But you can't have it all. You just can't have it all. Importantly, this year's Oscars did precisely what the Oscars are designed to do. They rewarded a big Hollywood production that was seen by lots of people and demonstrates the best of what the U.S. film industry can do. The Oscars are not and have never been about awarding the quote-unquote best movie. That's nonsense. That sort of thing is too subjective. It's impossible. They are, rather, a Hollywood trade show. They're a demonstration to the world that this is what the United States film industry can do when it gathers all of the world's talent in one place, America, land of immigrants. And they appeal to audiences, and they do something great, and they show it to the rest of the world, and everybody loves it. That's what the Oscars are for. And in that regard, Oppenheimer is the best picture winner of probably the last 20 years. Alyssa, what is your takeaway from Oscars 2023?
So I have to confess that because I am a normie, I missed that the Oscars started at 7 and I was putting my kids to bed. So I did not have the experience that Sunny had of feeling like, oh, we're off to a bad start. I hopped in. Things were going pretty well. I thought this was...
And you showed up right about the time that John Cena came out, right? Like, mostly naked?
I mean... Like, as someone who has long been a champion of John Cena's comedic talent, like, I felt very micro-targeted by that segment and very happy about it. I will say my husband wandered into the room as that was happening, was like, what? And left. But I thought that was pretty great. I mean, the fact that they managed to bring in, like, naked John Cena as a way to engage with Oscars history and make, like, a good new joke out of it was just... extremely well executed and fun. And I thought the awards were good, right? The awards are good. I think I liked Poor Things the most of any of us. Is that?
Do you think that's
accurate? Yeah. And The New Yorker's Emily Nussbaum refers to it as Bizarro Barbie, which I think is basically correct. It's always tricky when there is a big narrative around a category and then it gets upset and the person who actually wins sort of feels like they have to apologize. I think Lily Gladstone is incredibly good in Killers of the Flower Moon. I think I would probably like a version of Killers of the Flower Moon in which she was really an undisputed lead actress a bit more than the one that we got. Or maybe not. I mean, I think I would have felt differently about it. I don't think the version we got necessarily would be worse. But I do think there was a real question there about the extent to which she was actually the lead. That probably worked against her to a certain extent. And this is just not a case of an outstanding performance losing out to a mediocre one, right? Like, Emma Stone is kind of awesome in Poor Things. She's daring. She's weird. You know, there has been a lot of debate about the movie's sex scenes and sort of sexual explicitness and attitude toward sex. But she's also just incredibly bold and interesting in portraying Bella Baxter in toddler mode, you know, as like, you know, an adult woman who's not toilet trained, who is, you know, figuring out the ways the rules of society work. She just makes every single sort of developmental stage in that character work. And so it's definitely the most acting, but it's also extraordinarily good acting. And so I felt bad for Lily Gladstone for not winning. I'm sure it's really hard to be in a position where, you know, you have been sort of built up to this and everyone expects it. But I also felt really bad for Emma Stone for sort of having to go up there and be a little bit apologetic about it. Versace also owes her a lot for making her a dress that broke. That's not great. That shouldn't happen. So that was sort of the big moment of the night, and I felt sort of a little bad for everyone involved, even as I thought it was a basically good decision. I know also people did not like the in memoriam segment, and like, yeah, just focus on the people more closely. No one cares about the furniture around it. But the way it opened with Alexei Navalny really jolted me in a way that I thought was, you know, I think it was appropriate to have him start that segment of the broadcast. But also it's just a reminder that, you know, film can keep someone's voice alive, right? That, you know, we can, you know, it's possible to create sort of fantasies and confection, but like one of the things that film does is it creates a record. And, you know, Navalny is dead. I think most people believe that he has been murdered, but he will live on in part because of the documentary that captures him as direct and forceful and clear about what he's doing. And that's a really important role for film. That is, you know, one of its many political roles. And, you know, for an in memoriam segment to both honor a person, but also an idea of film in that way, I thought was sharp and striking. And I was really glad they did that. Also, yay Oppenheimer. Yay Christopher Nolan.
Oppenheimer and Nolan and the big wins there, Peter. That is clearly the big story of the night. Rewarding, you know, one of the two biggest movies of the year like this is just, I feel like it's a straightforward win for the idea of the Oscars itself, like why it exists.
In some ways, this is a sort of a payback for, as you said, the Oscars being shaken by The Dark Knight not making it into the five Best Picture nominees when it came out, right? And that's why they expanded the category. It is really a recognition that Nolan is a generational talent leading the field in so many ways. I think Oppenheimer is pretty clearly his best movie, his most accomplished movie, the one that is both just best on its own terms, but also has the highest degree of difficulty. And so this was the right decision in so many ways. It is also, as I think somebody pointed out, the first movie in something like 22 years to win Best Picture and make $100 million at the box office. The fact that all of this was able to come together was really nice after some very rocky years for the movies. And Nolan's speech was a perfect example of why Nolan is such a formidable filmmaker and such a likable one. It was so humble and so in love with the idea of movies and the making of movies, the process of it, right? His speech was about the idea that movies are only 100 years old. They're not past their prime. They're still in their infancy. And it was this just incredible kind of the sense of horizon of infiniteness of the power of movies was there. And then, you know, thanking his wife as the producer of all of my movies and my children, right? Like bringing it back to something that you see in his movies in many ways, right? But like that this is about that he's like he's not an ordinary guy, but he is somebody who's like, he's got a family. He's like devoted to this. And it's just a great example, you know, of what people like about Christopher Nolan. But the movie I want to single out, I think that Oppenheimer's obviously the big story. But the second story that I think people should be focusing on is the visual effects Oscar for Godzilla Minus One, a movie we sadly did not get to do a full segment on this podcast, but is just a great movie in so many ways. It was made for somewhere between $10 and $15 million adjusted for US, and it looks fantastic. It doesn't look exactly perfect in every shot, but it looks fantastic. The effects work looks so much better, frankly, than these TV episodes that cost $25 million. It looks so much better than $200 million movies that we watch all the time. And to see that awarded, but also to see the way that those filmmakers incorporated ideas and sort of and techniques and stylistic stuff from two big American filmmakers. That movie is heavily indebted first to Steven Spielberg. The third act is basically a reverse Jaws. The opening Godzilla attack on the island is extremely indebted to the T-Rex attack sequence in Jurassic Park. Without just feeling like, oh, this is a ripoff. I love Steven Spielberg as an action director because no one else directs motion better and no one else seems to control the possibility space, which is what action scenes are about. great. They're about leading your mind along and then and showing you what could happen, and you create suspense from that. And right, because you're locked into the way that the characters are thinking about their physical surroundings and what are the available options. No one's better at that than Steven Spielberg. And I feel like so many of the imitators of Spielberg don't really get what he is doing with the way that he shoots these things. And this is one of the first movies where I've ever watched and thought, oh my gosh, they didn't just rip off Spielberg by picking shots that kind of are homages to famous Spielberg shots. They just understood what he was doing and were like, we can do that too. And so those bits are great. But then there's also, as you have pointed out, Sonny, a huge indebtedness in that movie to Christopher Nolan, and in particular to Dunkirk. The third act is on the one hand, it is a reverse Jaws. It is also an homage. It is a Godzilla-fied version of Dunkirk in just the best and most delightful way of people seeing, look, the authorities can't do this. We are going to have to come together as individuals, as a people, into a collective act in order to save the day. And thinking about that, it makes me realize, you know what that is? That's also making movies, because movies are this sort of strange collective dance that a whole bunch of different people with different ideas from all walks of life have to come together to make this thing. Even small movies, you know, you watch the credits and there's dozens and dozens of people, and the big movies have hundreds or even thousands. It's just an incredible act of collective art making. And both Dunkirk and Godzilla Minus One managed to capture that in some way in the structure of their story. So I was just totally thrilled to see that movie win Best Visual Effects, especially against some pretty accomplished competitors, in particular The Creator and Mission Impossible: Dead Reckoning, both of which really look great and are quite well crafted movies, but much more expensive.
I was going to say I that was a category where all of the winners, I think, you could make a pretty solid case for them. In particular, The Creator, which is a movie that is not as cheap as Godzilla Minus One, for sure. I mean, it still, I think, costs $70 or $80 million, something like that.
It's a production budget of about $80 million, and then there's some tax credits that shave off the
right,
cost.
Right. So, I mean, like, it's a much more expensive movie, but it's a movie that still looks better than
almost everything.
95% of the, you know, $200 million movies that you see out there, it just looked great. And I love the little bits where they show the layering of the effects.
Yeah.
The very quick, like, montages where you see how a shot like that, like the ones featured, come together. It's just a real reminder of the magic of all this.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely an argument for adding a stunts category to the Oscars, right? I mean, they had that little sort of stunts, you know, montage. And the clip they show where you have a cameraman following one of these stuntmen out of a window in a harness was jolting and cool. And, you know, getting people...
It wasn't just Tom Cruise who did that Halo jump, right? Like, there was a cameraman who had to leap out backwards... Yeah. But in order to capture that Halo jump in the, not this last year's Mission Impossible, but the previous one, that wasn't, I mean, Tom Cruise deserves, like, did a lot there, but there was another guy just wearing a Steadicam while also operating a parachute.
Yeah. And so, you know, get people excited about the craft of movies by showing them the craft behind the moments that they're already excited about, right? I mean, this was a step in the right direction. Maybe, you know, we can get a stunts academy presided over by Bill Jabari, and we'll all get what we want. But look, I thought it was a good ceremony. I thought there were very few things that could have happened that would have actively upset me. And, you know, it's a mark of a strong year for movies. I think we're in for a rougher one this year. There's just less stuff coming out because of the strikes, and we could be headed into another strike with the, you know,
IATSE.
But this was a good year.
It was a good year. Just one quick fact check thing. Argo was the last movie, I believe, to make 100 million or more at the box office and also win Best Picture.
Fact check. Correction appended. Apologies. Regret the error.
But the last, like, legit blockbuster to win Best Picture was Return of the King, I think. I mean, that's, you know, 2000, what? That was the 2004 ceremony, I think. And, you know, again, like, that's a movie that deserved to win Best Picture, but it was also kind of a lifetime achievement award for the Lord of the Rings series, you know, as a whole. Oppenheimer is a very different beast. And I loved, you know what I loved? I think it was Nolan. It wasn't Hoyt van Hoytema. I think it was Nolan thanking IMAX, thanking Rich Gelfond at IMAX for believing in Oppenheimer enough to put together a, you know, allow them to do the things they wanted to do in IMAX for a movie that does not scream this is an IMAX picture, right? It's not, Oppenheimer's not big spectacle, though there is bigness and spectacality to it. You know, it is a movie about people talking in rooms. It is partly black and white. It is largely black and white for long stretches. And the fact that, you know, they had to develop new film stock for that to make it work is just a, it's a real testament to everybody kind of coming together and making that work.
Listeners who are interested in the technical aspects of film production should go read about what Christopher Nolan and Hoyt van Hoytema had to do in order to shoot a lot of this on IMAX, but also just how they conceived of a movie that was, that is in many ways quite intimate and talky as a big epic IMAX film. The quote, I believe, from Nolan was that, well, you know, IMAX is great for shooting landscapes. And this is a movie that features a lot of close-ups and a lot of talking, so we decided to treat our actors' faces as landscapes, and the landscape is the face. And when you rewatch the movie with that in mind, it's so obvious. They shoot Cillian Murphy's face like it's this, like it's a mountain, and it's as gorgeous and sort of impenetrable as a giant snowy mountain. And you look at it and you think, wow, that's wonderful. But also, I don't, you know, there's a lot of mystery there. And it's pretty incredible what they were able to do. And taking that idea of, we're going to use the biggest film stock, we're going to use these incredibly difficult to move around cameras in order to make this intimate, talky drama feel epic. That's what makes Nolan great. That's what makes movies great.
Yeah. And a lovely moment with Cillian Murphy winning, you know, this justice for Sunshine. We can write
28 days later, man.
We can write all these historical wrongs. One last note. My favorite award of the night may have been to Jennifer Lame. Jennifer Lame, right?
Is it Lame or Lame?
I think it's like, I don't know. I may be mispronouncing it, and I apologize if I am. But the editing on Oppenheimer really is its most amazing feat. It's a 3-hour movie about people talking in rooms. It felt like it was about 2 hours long. And not every 3-hour movie this year felt shorter than its runtime. I'll just say that. So good for her. Good for Oppenheimer. Good for the Oscars. What do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on this year's Oscar ceremony? Peter?
Thumbs up.
Alyssa?
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up. Great show. Just cancel the Oscars from now on. You're never going to top this again. This is it. This is as good as it gets. All right. That's it for today's show. Many thanks to our audio engineer, Jonathan Siri, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.